I've worked all of my adult life in prisons. I'm British, I grew up in London, but when I was 18, I went to Uganda looking for adventure and volunteered with a hospice. Through the hospice, I ended up looking after dying prisoners, and I bulldozed my way into Uganda's maximum security prison. And the people I met there and the things I saw changed my life. And since then, I've become a lawyer, and I started an organization initially when I was 21 as the African Prisons Project, and now as Justice Defenders. And our work now is all around equipping people from defenseless communities to defend justice in defenseless communities through legal education and training and practice. I'm part of a community of about 350, mostly prisoners and prison officers and ex-inmates, working alongside lawyers and legal academics, studying law from 37 prisons in Uganda and Kenya, and working to defend the defenseless. Last year, our community worked on 10,000 prisoners' cases. These are prisoners who didn't have access to representation, and 5,000 of them were released from prisons by the courts as a result.
Alexander, am I hearing this correctly? Your team worked on 10,000 cases, and out of those 10,000 cases, you have a 50% rate of people having their convictions overturned?
10,000. We worked on 10,000 cases last year, and half of those whose cases we worked on were released. Because we work around the world, actually. It's the case in my experience, and I spent time in about 130 prisons in about 17 countries, that it's our poor and our uneducated who end up in prisons. But in countries like Uganda and Kenya, between 80 and 90% of prisoners never meet a lawyer. And we find that a little legal knowledge can go a tremendous way in helping people who shouldn't be in prison to secure their freedom and to access bail or to be acquitted at trial or to have unjust convictions overturned. We work in places where the police are under-resourced and to sometimes use brutality as a way of getting confessions. They're under pressure to be seen to be solving crime. Places where courts are overstretched and don't have the resources that they need, so judges can't always deliver justice in the way that they want to. Our work is asking, what does it look like to build common cause? Working in adversarial justice systems, which are found all over Africa and in the UK and the United States, what does it look like to bring unexpected allies together and to recognize that whether one's a prosecutor or a judge or a death row inmate or a member of the police, we all want to live in societies which are fair, societies where we're equally protected by and accountable to the law. And what does it look like to come together to celebrate the work that's needed to be done to create societies which are fair and to love each other within justice systems and to love those we serve?
Hey everyone, this is David Gunger, and you're listening to Undaunted, a podcast about radical peacemakers. Today, my guest is Alexander McLean, and he is a lawyer and an activist based in London. Our conversation is one that I'll always cherish because Alexander inspired me so much. It is also the final episode of season one for Undaunted. We will be coming back with season two in 2021. We're so glad that you've joined us along the ride. And now, without much further ado, here's my conversation with Alexander. Alexander, thanks so much for joining us. I'm wondering if there was a moment in your life that you can point towards, maybe it's a story or a person that you met, that sets you on this trajectory.
I started volunteering at a hospice in London when I was 16. I'd go there every Sunday after church, and I quickly saw that people who were dying had a tremendous amount of wisdom to offer me. And it was a formative process spending time with them. I read in a newspaper about a hospice in Uganda and asked if I could go and volunteer, but they said at 16 I was too young. I'd really had my heart set on going to Oxford. I come from a family that doesn't have a background of going to university, and I wanted to go to the best, but Oxford rejected me, saying I couldn't think laterally. So I decided to take a year out, and then I was 18, and the hospice in Uganda said I was old enough to volunteer with them. So I decided to go. It was really tough for my parents. They were very worried. My mum got shingles the day I left. And I spent a month initially with this hospice as they went to people's homes around Kampala, Uganda's capital, taking them medication and food as they died from cancer and AIDS and other diseases. I didn't feel that I could do very much to be useful as a British teenager. Sometimes I was invited to say a prayer, and always I was met with great warmth and hospitality from the patients. But one day we went to Malago, Uganda's national referral hospital, where the hospice team was taking morphine to a dying man on one of the medical wards. As the hospice team went to see their patient, I saw this man lying on the floor by the toilet in the ward. He was lying on a plastic sheet without clothes on. And I said to a nurse, "What happened to this guy?" She said, "The police found him unconscious in a market. We don't know his name. We don't know if he's got any family. We think he's diabetic and in a diabetic coma, but because he doesn't have any money, he doesn't get any care. We're waiting for him to die." I saw that he was lying in a pool of urine, and the flesh on his bottom and back was rotten down to the bone. He was decomposing while he was still alive. I went back to the hospice and I spoke to Anne Merriman, who's worked in Africa since about 1960. She went from the UK to Nigeria as a nun and a doctor. And she said, with someone like that, even though he's dying, he can die when he feels loved and cared about and valued. So I went back the next day and I bought a basin and a bar of soap and a towel, and a nurse trained by the hospice helped me. We tied bandages around our noses because of how his rotting flesh stank, and we washed him, and I got him some clothes and some bedding, and I tried to advocate for him with the doctors that although he was poor and had no money and no family, they might take care of him. And for 5 days I washed him and tried to advocate for him, and I came on the sixth day and he died the night before. He was lying dead and naked on the floor. And after a while, a porter came with a trolley with a dead woman on it and put the man on top of the woman and said they'd go in a mass grave together with everyone else who had no one to bury them. And it was a turning point in my life because that guy died like a dog and was buried like trash. And I think it was the first time in my life that I realized that there are people in our world whose lives are judged to have no value. And I called my mum that evening and I cried for him because it hit me with a bang, the injustice of it all, the inequality. I spent 3 months on that ward with people who've been abandoned by their families, who are dying of AIDS with tuberculosis, and I'd take care of them before they died. And I formed this kind of ragtag community of medical students and nurses and security guards from the hospice and gardeners. We weren't well educated, we didn't have money, but we had this desire to serve together. And it taught me a tremendous amount about the power of coming together to serve, and that actually you don't need to have tremendous amounts of money or education or age or wisdom to serve, but I guess the formation of our hearts can equip us. And sometimes we see things and we have to respond to them. I heard a podcast at the weekend which mentioned the phrase that the heart can't feel what the eyes haven't seen. And I guess that we saw things there which moved us to serve. And we met prisoners there. My times with prisoners in hospital were really formative.
We'll be right back with more from Alexander. Friends, if you have enjoyed Season 1 of Undaunted, I encourage you to check out our website, www.telosgroup.org. Telos exists to help build communities of peacemakers. In 2021, we will have a lot of new content coming your way, as well as opportunities for trips to the Holy Land and trips to the American South, where we can learn from amazing peacemakers together. So once again, check out our website at www.telosgroup.org. Also, if you would, help us spread the word about this podcast. Share this season with a friend or a loved one. Rate us on iTunes. It really helps. And now back to our conversation with Alexander.
Since I was a young boy, I'd known I wanted to be a lawyer, a barrister in particular, a court attorney. I'd loved public speaking from when I was young, and I'd been strongly influenced by reading about the death penalty in America. And over the last days, as we've been hearing about George Floyd's death and hearing about Black Lives Matter, I've reflected a lot on the pictures and stories which really formed me when I was 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 12. And my dad used to take me to our local library and I spent hours and hours reading. And I remember picking up one book And it had this picture, I think it's from 1910 or 1920, of a black guy in a black and white striped uniform, not so different from those that I see in prison in Kenya, being strapped into an electric chair by four or five white men in suits. And his eyes were so expressionless, it was like he was dead whilst he was still alive. And I realized that this is what the law can do and society can do. It can remove hope for a future. It can make one feel dead while still living. I read about people like George Stinney, who was 14 when he was accused of murder, and the sheriff said that if he confessed, he'd buy him ice cream. And he was taken to court, and an all-white jury took less than 10 minutes to find him guilty. He was taken to the electric chair, but he was only about 5 foot and he was too small, so they made him sit on his Bible so that his head could get into the electrode. And tears were streaming down his face as they electrocuted him, and the mask fell off. So people, I guess, could see this petrified child being electrocuted to death over 8 minutes. I read about Willie Francis, who was 17, another black American boy, and he was sentenced to death for murder. I don't know the circumstances of the case, but he was electrocuted. But as he was being electrocuted, he shouted, "Shut it off, shut it off!" And he was still alive, and he wouldn't die. They took him out of the electric chair, and the case was taken to the US Supreme Court to ask whether it was constitutional to electrocute him again. And they decided it was. And a year after the first electrocution, they did it to him again, successfully. I think that planted really powerful seeds in me about how the state has force in our lives as individuals. And I think how calculated the killing was, how you're taking an individual and strapping them with strap after strap after strap after strap, I guess a bit like George Floyd was in handcuffs when he was killed. It's making someone totally defenseless and then in a very calculated way killing them. And I guess I was struck by the fact that these were poor black boys who hadn't had access to good lawyers and whose families didn't know how to advocate for them. That really formed my heart. And then I was in Uganda and I started meeting prisoners in hospital. And I met one called Peter Kamia. And he was outside of the ward, and the nurses didn't want him in the ward with the other patients because he had AIDS with Norwegian scabies, which is something that people with AIDS sometimes get. And it makes all your skin peel off. So all over his body, his skin was peeling off. And I was told that it makes the skin, like our insides, peel as well. I took him into the ward and I started washing him. And this group of American missionaries came onto the ward and they went around praying for the patients. And other patients had their families there, they had bedding, they had food, they had clothes. And they left the ward without praying for Peter. I called them back and I said, "I can't understand, because you came and you prayed for the people who have relatives, who have bedding, who have food. Look at this guy, he's a prisoner who's got absolutely nothing. His skin's falling off." And they said a prayer for him then, and I said, "Well, can you help me to wash him and to try and buy medicine for him and to treat him?" They said, "Oh, well, our pastor said we can only pray." And I guess that this was quite a formative time for my faith, and I wondered what it looks like to love one's neighbor. And I looked after Peter for a week, washing him, trying to take care of him, to advocate for him alongside the woman who's now my wife and others, and he died at the end of it. Or I looked after a chap called Fred Muburu, who'd been in prison for a year, accused of stealing a goat, and the prison officers had beaten him until he had a wound and he got tetanus in it. And he was in hospital for weeks, and sometimes he'd have convulsions and fall out of his bed onto the floor, and we'd find him just left on the floor, no one would put him back into bed. But with this group of, like, ragtag group of Ugandans and Austrian medical students, some of whom are now great friends, we looked after him for hours each day until he died. And with prisoners, if no one comes to collect their bodies within 3 days, they go in a mass grave, and we held a funeral for him. I think the proximity changes us. And I guess that I went into Uganda as a very young man who'd, my family didn't have money, but the British government used to pay for poor but bright children to go to expensive schools, and I got one of these assisted places. And this was the time when I really became proximate to those on the margins of society. But I also saw that there was joy in serving them, and that it was formative for me. And I think it was that experience in that hospital and months, meeting many individuals, but especially people like Fred and Peter or a chap called Charles who'd been arrested by the police. And when they arrested him, they smashed his skull in three places and broke his ribs and his fingers. When I met him, he was bleeding out of his eyes and his ears and his bottom. And I think that when you get close to people and when you do things like washing them or feed them, you see actually, regardless of what this person's done, they're just like me. They want to feel safe. They want to feel heard. They want to feel seen. They want to feel loved.
Alexander, did you grow up in a religious household?
So my family were fairly lapsed Catholics. I sang in my Anglican church choir for a few years at secondary school. I had a great aunt. My dad's from Jamaica. She was from Jamaica, who died when I was 15, and her funeral in the Pentecostal church was much more lively than like the normal Sunday service in the Anglican church. So I got baptized in the Pentecostal church when I was 16. And I was moved by the strong sense of community and the sense of black pride I found there. The congregation was mostly older Jamaicans, and there was a dignity in them, and a generosity of spirit and wisdom and a powerful sense of solidarity, which I hadn't seen celebrated anywhere. And there were certain customs which I learnt about. I was one of the ushers and we'd always wear a suit. One occasion I attended and I hadn't shaved and I was wearing casual clothes. And a wonderful lady called Sister Julius said, "Brother Alex, you look like Bushman." It was a fascinating education in church and loyalty and generosity and kindness. I guess I went out to Uganda and I started wondering what it looked like for my faith to play out in my life. And when I was looking after these people in a hospital, sometimes like a nurse would say, I can see that God's working through you and God will bless you and this kind of thing. But I couldn't really understand it because often they'd say that. Like on one occasion, I was trying to carry someone to the toilet and they were pooing on the floor as I was getting them there. And like that was the nurse's reaction, but she didn't actually help me to take this guy to the loo. And so I wondered, and I'm still wondering, what it looks like to live out our faith and to put words into action and what it looks like for me to do that.
Did you have a spiritual practice that helped ground you during this time?
I think that during that time, I guess I felt like again and again, I was stepping into the unknown. And so I started to experiment with prayer. And I guess I started to get something of a sense of vocation over the years as I was starting my legal studies and spending all my free time in prisons in Africa. And I started to get a sense that maybe there was work for me to do around working for justice. And Alexander means defender of men. And I guess I wondered what it looked like to put that into practice. So I guess I went through my 20s, not in church for all of it. And I was moving around between university and then working in different parts of Africa, but starting to develop a deeper faith and seeing God show up in my life and in ways which started to transform me. And sometimes people speaking into my life or prophesying over me in a way that I'm a natural skeptic in many ways, but in a way that challenged me. I reached my late 20s and I've been doing this work for about 10 years and I realized that I didn't have a relationship with peace and I had this sense of calling to do justice work, but like my mind was always on the go and I think I'd kind of become a little bit emotionally immune. I'd seen a lot of death and suffering in my late teens and early 20s and for most of my 20s I stopped crying. I switched off tears. And I'd gotten married and my wife and I had had miscarriages and experienced pain, but I didn't cry. And I realized that I was good at not feeling sadness or real anger, but that I also wasn't great at feeling joy. And so I started to ask, what does it look like to live with peace? And to recognize that my work wasn't my identity, that even if I had a calling and a calling around justice, I wasn't called to have all the answers to my prayers. I was called to try and step out in faith and to step out with trust. And so I started hanging out with Benedictines and Franciscans. And I realized that in the Catholic Church, there are communities which for hundreds and hundreds of years have balanced action with contemplation. And I started to learn from them and to spend time at a Benedictine monastery near London, where I learned about Lectio Divina, a prayerful way of reading scripture, which says that God can speak to us just as we are. If we're high on drugs, drunk, in the midst of pain, frustration, you name it. If we're a Muslim, a Christian, an atheist, or anything, if we know the Bible inside out or not at all, he can speak to us just as we are. And I started to wonder, what does it look like to live with peace? And what does it look like to balance action and contemplation? So nowadays, I consider myself a bit of an Anglo-Catholic Pentecostal. I guess I look to Jesus's life and I think, like, what an incredible example of someone who turned the status quo on its head. What an example of finding value where others see worthlessness. What an example of subversively inspiring and challenging people to dance towards a new reality and to let go of some of the things that the world say make us successful or bring us joy, and to, I guess, to find ourselves in giving something of ourselves away. And so now, I guess, in terms of our work as justice defenders, some of us are Christians, some of us are atheists, some of us are Muslims, but I recognize that the work that we're doing has a spiritual element, because we're, most of us are people who are living in prison now. Some are on death row. They've experienced their own pain, and yet every day we're making a choice to step into other people's pain, to work on cases of people who are aching and have often been rejected by many. We talk about what it looks like to be servant lawyers and to use the legal knowledge we've acquired to lift up others from a posture of being before them in humility, saying, let me serve you. And our values are around bravery and solidarity and humility.
Can you share with us about some of your team members who are currently on death row?
So when it comes to our people on death row, we've got men and women, some who've been there for many years, some who've been recently condemned to death. In Uganda and Kenya, it used to be mandatory to give the death penalty for murder. Judges didn't have any discretion. In both countries, the law's now changed, and in both countries, our law students on death row have been involved in changing that law, so a judge never has to give the death penalty. They can if they think it appropriate, but they're not bound to. And for me, it was beautiful to see those on death row contributing to those cases and making their voices heard. Our first female law student and University of London law graduate, following in Nelson Mandela's footsteps in studying law with the University of London from prison in Africa, is a woman called Susan Chigula. And the case in Uganda, which resulted in the mandatory death sentence being abolished, is in Susan's name. And she was the lead petitioner in it. These are countries where can be sentenced to death for a variety of crimes. When I first visited death row in Uganda, I was surprised to hear of people there for treason and cowardice and mutiny, or to be told about a man called Edward Mpaji, who, when he'd been on death row for 10 or 12 years, it was discovered that the person he'd murdered was still alive, but it took about another 6 years before he was released. Or someone who'd gone out and he'd used a penknife to cut a mango from a neighbour's mango tree. Because he'd stolen the mango and because he's used a penknife to cut it from the tree, he was sentenced to death as an armed robber. I think about one of our female University of London students called Ruth, who's probably about 23 or 24, and she was sentenced to death last year. And she went into prison shortly after leaving high school and quickly became a paralegal with us and a spoken word artist, and her prison has fashion shows, and she's often crowned as the winner in her prison. She's articulate and eloquent. And she said to me some time ago, you know, when I came into prison, I felt suicidal. And in Kenya, it's an imprisonable offence to attempt suicide, though that wasn't why she was there. She said, now my life has purpose as I work on my fellow inmates' cases and help them to be reunited with their families and to go home. And so I look at those of us who are on death row and I see strength and resilience in them. I think about people like Maurice Kabiria, who was one of our first Kenyan law students, who was sentenced to death, I think, in 2005 and again in 2008. He studied law with the University of London from death row. And about 18 months ago, he was called for his appeal. He only got a week's notice that he was going to be taken to the court for his appeal. And his fellow University of London students worked on his appeal for him. And he went to court and he was released. His death sentence was overturned. It was beautiful for me because even when he had been on death row, he'd been studying law and working in the legal clinic in that prison to serve others. Then it was his fellow students who worked on his case. And now he oversees our work at two prisons in Machakos in Kenya, overseeing our legal clinics there. And he trains prison officers alongside prisoners as paralegals. And he took a case to the High Court of Kenya last year around remission, the right to have one sentence reduced. And he said that it was unconstitutional, that remission wasn't being applied equally in all cases. And the judge agreed with him. And as a result, hundreds and hundreds of prisoners have been able to benefit from reduced sentences through remission. So for me, I've been inspired by the courage of those on death row who've used their time there to serve others. Another who's I've just seen has sent me a WhatsApp message as we've been speaking, called William Okumo, was also on death row for maybe 8 or 10 years. And he said from death row, in prison, we have brains that can move mountains. And he's another poet. And I think that I've been moved by the eloquence of so many of our people and their resilience. And these are people who like might share a 6-foot by 5-foot cell with 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 other people. Or some of the prisons we work in are standing room only. Like half of the prisoners will sit for half the night and the other half stand and then they swap over. And I'll go to prison with those of us who've been in prison, who've been released, and they say, well, this officer used to whip me and this one used to kick me. Or we gather together as a community for assemblies. And these are times when we stop, we look back and we recognize what's gone well and what's broken our hearts. And we light candles and we give each other flowers and we look to the future with hope. And we have one of these assemblies at one of the prisons that we work in. And Maurice had just been released from death row and it was his first time coming to assembly as a free man. And he came into the room we were holding it in, where we always hold it. He said, oh, this is the death room. And he told us how he'd been taken to that prison. And on his arrival, he had been beaten till he was unconscious in that room. But still, he took part in the prayers and the worship and participated fully. So there's resilience amongst those that you might least expect it. I think about all the prisons I've visited around the world, and I've only visited one in America, which was in Texas. I visited a death row inmate there, and I think it was in San Antonio, and he'd been taken there to go to court for his appeal, and he was in this cell that didn't have a window. It had one door made out of bars and another door made out of solid metal. And he was allowed out of the cell for either 45 minutes or an hour a day to walk up and down a corridor in chains. I thought, America spends more money than anywhere else in the world in its prisons, much more, and it designs them to dehumanize. It designs them to take away hope, to take away a sense of agency, to make people live in fear, to make prisoners and prison officers fear each other. I think about death row in Uganda and Kenya and other countries I visited around Africa, and often it's true, it's massively overcrowded. And maybe there's not very much food and there's no beds. But still I see people studying for basic literacy, studying at primary level, studying at secondary level, now studying at degree level. I see prisoners and prison officers playing chess or playing volleyball together. I see churches are thriving. I see hope, even in the shadow of the gallows. And I've seen now, time and again, people being released from death row and us taking on law students when they're on death row and then getting knowledge of the law and winning their their freedom. So I feel so strongly about the death penalty, and I think about what's been happening in America and about police killings. And when I was about 19, I became friends with an executioner in Uganda. And I liked him very much, but literally he'd had blood on his hands. And when Uganda would execute, they'd hang people, but then prison officers would smash the prisoners' heads with hammers and crowbars to speed up their death. This guy had been involved in that. And I saw he was a kind and thoughtful man, and his salary was maybe $100 a month, and he got a bonus for being involved in executions. I got to know his wife, and she said, actually, he's got such a problem with alcohol. I'm thinking about leaving him. And then I did research, speaking to prison doctors and chaplains and warders on death row and executioners in different parts of the world. And I see how when we're involved in a process of killing and harming others, it brutalizes us as well. But very often we don't hear the perspective of those who are on the front lines of our justice systems and the toll that the work takes on them. And we can see when they mess up, and we can be quick to condemn them, but without always understanding the realities of what it is to work in a justice system and what's asked of those who are doing it. We so far had 22 African prisoners and prison officers graduate with their University of London law degrees. We've got about another 50 who are studying towards them. Our first graduate, a chap called Moses, has gone from being a prisoner in the maximum security prison in Kampala to a prosecutor in the Ugandan army. The Ugandan army doesn't have defense lawyers, but someone who's been wrongly imprisoned knows the power of a prosecutor. And I think that he has a degree of empathy and a perspective that few others will have. And so I'm really excited to be helping others to acquire education. And I've never really spoken about it in terms of our work, but our work is a significant part of it. It's about Black excellence. And I don't see it celebrated in the UK. And I'm not sure to what extent you celebrate it in the US. But it's saying, actually, there are Black brains that can move mountains, even on death row. And these people, some of whom have to study with flashlights because there's no light in their cells, their pass rates in their exams are so high, and we have many getting first-class marks, the highest you can get, despite the fact that their study environment is so challenging. And I hope that when people hear about our students in their prisons far away, that it might inspire them that education can transform each of us, that when we invest in education, no one can take that investment away from us, that none of us has to be defined by others' rejections or others' condemnation of us, that we can choose how we're defined, and that through education we can move from the margins of society into the positions where we're shaping our societies. Yeah, so I'm excited about education in all its forms.
Alexander, I'm sure you get asked all the time by Americans about race relations in America, although you are British. I would love to ask for some of your wisdom for what we're going through in America right now. And I wonder if you would be gracious enough to give us some of your thoughts.
I'd really been trying to structure my thoughts and to speak with a degree of eloquence, in part because I see that when brown people speak out about issues of race, then they get knocked down and attacked so often. That I work in law, academia, and international development, all areas where, if you look at the top, it's dominated by white people. I'm really used to biting my tongue and not speaking out. As a magistrate, a junior judge, the first time I went to visit a prison, which would be the prison I send people to, the prison officers thought I was a prisoner and locked me up. I think about the times when I've been stopped and searched, and I guess my own interactions, which have been painful, but I've learned to bite my tongue. And so I feel a bit vulnerable speaking about these things. I don't know how others will react. And the reality is that our work is almost exclusively funded by white people. But I thought, actually, it feels to me, based on my limited experience as a Brit who spent time in different parts of the world, who's a little bit familiar with America, who's worked a lot in East Africa, and whose dad comes from Jamaica, but it seems to me that since white people first encountered black people, they've been raping, beating, burning, torturing, and killing them. And that's the way it's been for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think about my ancestors are slaves and slave owners. And I think about like how slaves were treated, and like how the cat of nine tails, the nine-lashed whip, was used to whip slaves, but also my childhood, it was still being used in Jamaica as a punishment. And I think about it as a Brit, and part of our work is around the rule of law, and Britain prides itself in exporting the rule of law. But Britain went all over the world, including with America, and took its laws. And these were laws which were often very punitive and introduced or codified capital punishment where it wasn't before, and all sorts of corporal punishments, and its influence lives on. And so I guess I thought, well, is change possible? I thought about slavery, and I thought about Jim Crow. I thought about how I've been shaped by reading about the civil rights movement in America and anti-apartheid protesters in South Africa, and seeing in the face of tremendous white brutality and dogs attacking children and farmmen with fire hoses spraying people down, and just like lynchings, but also I think the much more cold-blooded killings of the people like Willie Francis and George Stinney, who I spoke about earlier, but so many others like them, that I guess cold-blooded and white on black violence seemed to be par for the course. And so I thought, well, where does change come from? And in our work, it's saying that even in places where the police can be exceptionally harsh, and in Kenya, until a few weeks ago, more people had been killed by the police for being out after the curfew time for this coronavirus than actually by the disease itself. And I've seen people who've suffered in so many different ways at the hands of police officers and prison officers or mob justice. Our response is saying, what does it look like as a community whose members have had their fingernails pulled out in the police station or been in prison for 10 years without a trial or been sexually assaulted in the police station? Not to respond. Our response isn't with anger or with rage, though I think that anger probably motivates many of us, but it's saying, how do we use the law? How do we use this least violent and in some cases very beautiful tool to bring freedom and to bring hope? What does it look like to respond to rejection and attack and violence and fear and othering with dignity and with wisdom and with our brains? And so I think that we're being invited in this moment, whether as Christians, and I think as Christians we have a special mandate to reach out to each other, to Christians and non-Christians, in love, because we're told to love our neighbours as ourselves. And I think we have to ask ourselves, who's our neighbour? My understanding when Jesus said that is it's everyone, that every man, woman and child is created in God's image. In Psalm 139, it talks about being knitted together in our mother's womb. I don't think that that's just relevant for Christians. I think that's relevant for absolutely everyone, that God knows us and is with us and loves us. So I think our mandate is to love. So I think in this moment, we're invited to be proximate to those who are different from us.
Alexander, for those who are listening and wonder where they can begin, and perhaps try to fight off a sense of nihilism that nothing can actually change. They try to fight for hope. I'm wondering if you could speak to our audience directly about trying to become agents of change for the mutual flourishing of our neighbors.
If we want to be instruments of change in the world, or if we want to change ourselves, we have to commit ourselves to persevering. We have to commit ourselves to having grace for ourselves and knowing, actually, we don't know it all. I'm having this conversation with you. Maybe I'll look back on this in 2 years or 2 months or 2 weeks and think, gosh, what I said was foolishness. And if only I'd known this or read this then, it would be totally different. But I'm showing up now in good faith in the best way that I can. I think that's all we can do every day. And to have grace on ourselves, that's okay. And it's better than saying, actually, I'm too scared to ask questions. I'm too scared to put myself out there. I'm too scared to raise these issues because I don't know what answers I'm going to get and if others are going to cut me down. So I think that we can all gain by trying to have the courage of our convictions and to take a step into the unknown. And for me, it's the moments when I've been most uncomfortable that I've grown the most and I've learned the most. I think that our lives can be relentlessly busy and we want to achieve and to be productive every day and get things done and to make an impact. And I think often we're missing the point. Last year, we had our fifth miscarriage. We had twins who died in the middle of pregnancy. And we had a funeral for them. We hadn't had funerals for our other babies who died. On the day of their funeral, I felt so broken. And as someone who's really used to showing up in other people's lives to try and encourage them or motivate them or with ideas or in whatever way I do, and I thought, actually, I've got nothing to offer anyone. And actually, their funeral was a tremendous blessing. There was my wife and me and a lady called Rose, who became the first black woman bishop in the Church of England, a guy from our church called SP, who played the guitar, and a funeral director called Tony. And SP and Rose and Tony loved on us in a way that really has shaped me since then. And Tony ended up taking a video of SP worshipping at our baby's funeral. I was watching it today, and it reminded me that even in the times of my life when I felt most broken, I've got nothing of value to offer anyone. God loves me unconditionally. I don't have to show up and prove myself, and others will step in and love me as well. And I felt that during those months after our babies died, I lived with a different perspective, because I lived more slowly. I lived more and present to the pain in others around me. I can rush through life so eager to achieve and to produce and to get things done, and there's one side of me that loves recognition and loves success and loves to be seen as a mover and shaker, and there's another that recognizes that there's freedom in giving it away and being part of a community of brothers and sisters that's side by side and as equals, and they're in tension. But I think it's, for me, it's saying, what does it look like to slow down and really encounter the people that I'm meeting now? Not just to come with my own agenda, my own ideas, and to drive the conversation, but to listen deeply, to listen to their eyes and to their facial expressions, and to really be in the present moment with them. And there's a prayer which really spoke to me very vividly at that time, and it's spoken to me really vividly since then. I think it's relevant to us now, and I'll share it with you, because I think this is a time when many people are living in fear and uncertainty, and they look into the future and they don't know where to find hope. And this was found on the body of a lady called Sister Odette Prevost. She was a nun in Algeria in the 1990s, at a time when Christians, members of religious orders, were being assassinated very frequently. And she was assassinated, and on her body, after she'd been murdered, this prayer was found, and it said, "Live today's day. God gives it to you. It belongs to you. Live it in God. Tomorrow's day belongs to God. It doesn't belong to you. Do not impose today's worry upon tomorrow. Tomorrow belongs to God. Hand it over to Him. The present moment is a frail footbridge. If you weigh it down with yesterday's regrets, tomorrow's anxiety, the footbridge gives way and you lose your footing. The past, God forgives it. The future, God gives it. Live today's day in communion with God." So for us at this time, when I think many of us are asking questions about the kind of society that we want to live in and how we want to show up ourselves and how we want to enable others to show up, what it looks like to welcome in those who've been othered, and to be mindful of our privilege and to think about how we can share it. We can be weighed down by the past, and we can be weighed down by fear for the future. And I'm not saying that we should ignore either, but I think that each day, in encounters that we have on public transport, or as we're getting our meals, or with people that we're passing in a corridor, there's an opportunity to encounter them and see them as God sees them, and to let them into our lives and to speak truth to us and to shape us. If we just slow down, and if we try to see with God's eyes and hear with God's ears and ask what it looks like to speak with God's mouth. A thank you for giving me this chance. And if you have a chance to give our website a shout out at some point, that would be great. It's justice-defenders.org.
Justice-defenders.org. Alexander, can you tell us ways that we can help support you at that website? I know that you have lots of different projects going on. Can you tell us any ways that we can help partner with you?
You've also got a campaign at the moment to pay fines for minor nonviolent offenders who are in prison because they've got fines, typically about $200, sometimes $100, sometimes $50, which they can't afford to pay. And so they might be in prison for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years for not paying. We've had people like a woman called Belly, who's 15, and she was pregnant. She was in prison for, if I recall correctly, because she'd gone to collect alcohol on behalf of an adult, and she had a fine of something like $150, and she couldn't pay it, and she'd been in prison for months and months and months. Another man who'd worked for someone for a day, the employer had no money to pay him, so he paid him in vegetables, and then the police accused him of stealing the vegetables. I don't know how many months he was in prison for, because he couldn't pay a fine. And so we know about 600 individuals by name who are imprisoned for minor non-violent offences, things like driving a motorbike without wearing a helmet, or selling alcohol outside of permitted hours. And we're paying fines to decongest prisons and get them back to their families at this time. And then we're asking, what does it look like to do digital justice? And in the same week that the US Supreme Court started going online, Kenyan prisoner and prison officer paralegals in our communities were doing online courts as well, so that prisoners in the prisons that they're in have a chance to go to court and have an online hearing and to keep the wheels of justice turning. And I received a video last week featuring a woman called Susan at Machakos Prison in Kenya, who went before a judge for this online court. She'd been accused of murder. She'd been in prison for 5 years awaiting her trial. And there's a video which shows her getting the not guilty verdict from the judge. And she falls on the floor in tears. And our prison officer paralegals burst into tears with her. And then in this video clip, for about a minute, they just embrace. The prison officer has her hands around Susan, and they're just embracing, and Susan's overwhelmed with emotion. So we've seen that it's possible to keep the wheels of justice turning at this time, and that technology can transform the way that justice is delivered, even in some of the world's poorest countries.
Undaunted is produced by our team at Telos. Telos is an organization committed to forming communities of peacemakers, equipping them to heal seemingly intractable conflict. Get connected to Telos by visiting our website, www.telosgroup.org, or follow us on social media, at the Telos Group. And please sign up for our newsletter, where we have info on live events, news, analysis, and different peacemaking resources. My name is David Gunger. I hope that you'll stay curious.